Productions.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 21 of the Wrestling Culture Podcast. Dave Musgrave and Dylan Hales here, joined by Chris Zellner and Will Power, is what I'm going to call him tonight because I don't want to say his last name. How's everyone doing?
All right.
I think we should call
or
him.
Or will
I
you
think
ask
he been
him
Will
again.
Censor?
My buddy Ditch wrote an article in the FSM magazine and called me Will Hat Rack. So, what the hell, bro?
That's great.
We did think about doing a Hans Schmidt Memorial show and inviting you on and calling it Triumph of the Will.
Hans Schmidt. He just died, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
He did.
Hopefully him dying will be enough to get him into the Observer Hall of Fame. So that's usually the only way older candidates get in.
Yeah,
to drop
it seems
dead.
That way.
But,
yeah.
Well, we do have Hall of Fame voter Chris Zellner on the line.
Yes. Yes.
We
I voted for him last year, so I'll vote for him again.
He should be in. I think no question about it, but...
Hold on, before you get stuck. Chris, did you vote for Dick Murdoch?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
That's a no-brainer.
I was about to kick you off the 80s project if you didn't. Just saying.
That's a no-brainer. I mean, come on.
Okay.
That's an immediate disqualifier from the 80s project if you don't vote for
for Dick Murdoch or Buddy Rose. You know, if you don't vote for either of those guys, you're off the set, man. You're done.
Oh, yeah, I'm voting for Rose this year for sure. I mean, that's another definite. And people that watch this AWA set will see why.
Yep, that's actually a
great
good
segue.
Topic. That actually is a very good segue to today's topic, which is, of course, the Best of the 80s set, the latest release, the AWA set. And, of course, me, Will, and Chris were the committee for this. So I'm going to let Dave handle some of the questions because I don't want to monopolize all that since he's the only outsider in terms of the process itself. But, you know, I just want to say that I think out of the gate, I think this set is going to be very unique. I think it's going to be, all of them have been unique to one degree or another. But I think this set has a lot of really great matches that people maybe not even realize the depth of the quality of great matches in the AWA. I think it's going to be a big surprise to people how many truly – actually, I'll go beyond that and say excellent matches there are. And it's also going to have a lot of these sort of like oddball, really entertaining curiosity matches because the AWA was such a weird promotion, particularly from the middle of the decade forward in terms of all these strange people that were coming in for little mini runs and then disappearing.
Well, Dylan, just to highlight the idea of oddball curiosities, the set opens up with Lord Alfred Hayes versus Bobby the Brain Heenan. So.
Sorry, guys, I went AWOL there. I went AWOL for a minute there, guys. I'm back. So
we hardly missed you. I'm just saying.
And it closes with Nikita Koloff versus Larry Zbyszko. So that's the range of this set. Bobby Heenan versus Lord Alfred Hayes is your opening match, and your closing match is Nikita Koloff versus Larry Zbyszko. And I think that actually illustrates very well how entertaining and to some degree all over the place this set is going to be. Not so all over the place that it's scatterbrained. There's a lot of constants, especially Nick Mockwinkle, but
You were saying all over the place in an affectionate manner. So
yes, very much so. Well, I just think there's a lot of variety on this set. I don't think it's, you know, there are a lot of guys. I mean, Bockwinkel shows up, I think, 39 times. I think he has like 39 matches on the set. Kurt Hennig has like 27. But there's still a ton of variety even within that. You got Bockwinkel wrestling everybody from a, you know, almost 60-year-old Pat O'Connor in 1981 to Bockwinkel wrestling Boris Zukov when he was almost 60 years old at the show. You know, you've got it's a lot of variety on this, even within the guys that are constants. It's not, you know, I mean, you do have your Kurt Hennig Bockwinkel matches, and your Martel Bockwinkel, and of course your Rose and Summers Midnight Rockers, which I would say those are probably the three biggest constant matchups. But there's still a ton of variety even beyond that. So anyway, that's my early filibuster, and I kind of want to turn it over to Dave to see if he's got any questions for us before we get into any more particulars and ranting. But
yeah. Well, I actually thought that I asked too difficult a question, but then I realized that I just lost the line because I got a dead no cell from Will on it. But Will, I wanted to ask you if you could kind of basically, could you discuss, like, I mean, how you came to selecting the committee that you did for this and kind of the match selection for anyone who's, you know, not familiar with the projects?
Oh, okay. Well, my good buddy Phil Schneider started this. When? Like 2005, 2006, somewhere around there? And David Bixon's band was originally running the project, but he had other projects he wanted to pursue. Phil reached out to me, and I said, okay, I'll do this. And so after that, what I did is I picked Phil and I came up with a group of guys that we felt were sick enough to actually watch hundreds of wrestling discs, to try and get the best matches off those discs. And then we would send the top 100, top 150, top 175, whatever the case may be, to people who would watch all the matches and rank them. And that's what we've done. And Chris Zellner has the unique Chris, have you been on every single set?
That's come out. Everyone but New Japan. I wasn't part of that one.
All of them but New Japan. But he was working on Texas.
Oh, wow.
While we were working on New Japan. So, you know, and then Dylan, my good friend there, I noticed that, God, this guy watches a lot of wrestling. And some of the guys that started the project with us, they kind of fell by the wayside because this takes a lot of time and a lot of energy to watch this and you know, get phone calls from me randomly throughout the week and say, hey, why aren't you finished watching disc 22 yet, you know? And I noticed Dylan watched a lot of wrestling, so we added Dylan to the list, and AWA is his first 80s project as being part of the committee. So I'm excited about him working on more projects, and as long as people keep participating and donating to the cause, you know, then we will continue to do these projects. But
More streamlined now than it was when we started. I mean, when we started with the first WWF set, me and Bix were basically watched the footage, almost all the footage that we had, and Phil and Tom, they come in. And none of us, they didn't really watch all the stuff that we had watched. It was just a total clusterfuck.
Help you realize that there are certain things that had to be fixed. Like all the matches are now in chronological order, whereas in the first set, you know, there was no order to how they were placed on the discs. And so you actually get to see the evolution of the companies throughout the decade, you know, for every set. And, you know, we make sure that if it exists, somebody's watched it. And that's the other thing, too, is with that first WWF set, there were a lot of house shows, a lot of MSG shows, a lot of TV. Just wasn't watched. It just wasn't in the collections.
And, yeah.
Anyone who knows me knows that.
And that's where you came in. That's where you came in. Because when we added you into the mix, you became you were the guy for all the footage, and you distributed it out to everybody, and it made it a whole lot easier for everybody to go through it.
I like to look at Will as like Tito from the Yugoslavia, you know? A project like this has to have a dictator, right? You have to have somebody who's your centralizing power, even if he's not necessarily in charge of the day-to-day stuff. You have to have your centralizing force. And if you remove your centralizing force, you get Bosnia-Herzegovina, right? You get Kosovo.
Yeah.
You get...
Okay.
I mean, you get...
I'll be your benevolent dictator, okay?
That's how I like to look at him. And I'm only half kidding. I actually kind of mean that. Like, you have to have a a centralized authority on a project like this. But you also have to have committees that are capable of working together and being agreeable and disagreeable without wanting to slaughter each other, you know, which I think me and Will and Chris are pretty good about.
Well, my buddy Charles, who we had on the show last time when we talked about the yearbook, he said it's too bad, you know, you deal with bootleg DVDs or you could put a project manager on your resume, you know. And, it's like, man, all this invested effort, you know, and I can't even capitalize off of it, you know. But
Will, I wanted to let you know that last episode we did with you had the most I think it was the most downloaded episode we ever had for like the first week at least. I didn't go through total numbers, but and I attribute it solely to you.
I attribute it solely to male strippers. Right.
So. Yes.
To me, off the air, like extra amusing to me.
Yeah. Well, I think Will brings that 50 Shades of Grey type demographic to the show too.
The lonely housewives who really enjoy that Texas drawl. That's what it is.
Yeah, I sound so Texan. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah, fucking me and my belt buckle and my ropers.
Those intermittent pauses when you're spitting out your chew.
Yeah, exactly. I got the Wranglers on. Got my button-up shirt with the roses and skulls on it. I'm good, man. Shit.
Your bolo tie.
Got my bolo tie. Shit, man. Deciding if I want to wear the snakeskin bolo today or the rabbit fur. You know, haven't decided yet. I don't know if they have rabbit fur bolo ties. I'm just making that shit up. Anyway, so
if they don't, they should. But
you know, but now that we've selected the AWA, the All Japan set, we're gonna have a mathematician Chris Harrington add up the ballots for that, and pretty soon we'll have a podcast out with Chris on the All Japan set, which I'm sure Chris Zellner will definitely be a part of. So.
Oh yeah.
And if we can't find anywhere to host it, I'm sure you two will be a part of it too. Hey.
Oh, for sure. Our pleasure.
But you know, we'll get Chris Zellner if I can find my buddy Childs Walker, who's he's actually a reporter with the Baltimore newspaper. What's it called? The Baltimore something or other.
Baltimore Sun.
I think it was Sentinel on the Wire. So.
Yeah. Okay. So he works for that paper, and so. He worked on the All Japan set, so maybe we can get him on an All Japan countdown show with Phil Schneider or something. So, the AWA.
You think there's any chance he'll run a feature on it, or?
No, hell no. Well, you know, what's he gonna write? My buddy Will bootlegs Japanese wrestling, and here's the top 20. My thoughts on him.
Yeah, just what Will needs is the NTV coming down on him, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man, I wish. AWA set.
Okay. I guess Dylan had suggested that perhaps I come up with some questions since I was the one not involved in the actual selection process. But I guess one of the questions I wanted to ask you guys is what are some of the differences stylistically and thematically between the matches you see on this set and some of the other ones that have been done?
Oh, that's actually
Chris.
A very good question.
You want me to go first?
I'll go first.
I want to hear AWA, Chris first because he's worked on all of the sets.
The AWA has a more amateur-based style because of Vern. So you see a lot more mat wrestling, especially in the early part, than you would on some of the other sets. You know, we guys like Brad Rankins and Greg Gagne and Jim Brunzel and Bob Winkle. And, you know, guys like that, there you see a lot more mat work in the early part. But as it goes along, that's where you see the shifting, where they try to adapt to what WWF's doing. You'll see a lot more, you know, a lot more violence, characters, and stuff like that. You'll see a little bit more comedy. And towards the end of the run, I mean, it's just a total, you know, potpourri of stuff. You got stuff coming from all sides. You know, you got your high flyer, you got your wrestlers, you got your geeks, you got your, you know, your violence, you got the women, you got everything. Yeah. and you got Larry Nelson and Raj Rungar. I mean, you got the one thing that is consistent about this set is you'll have the worst commentary.
Absolutely.
In pretty much the all the sets, and that's including Texas.
Yeah,
I mean,
I totally agree with that. I would say there's one thing I would add to what Chris said, and I agree with basically everything he said, but there's one thing I would add because it's something that I think people are going to notice and maybe think is a quirk when they first start watching the AWA tag matches, and by the time you get through it, you realize it's not really a quirk. AWA tag matches, as a rule, tend to have two face and peril segments in every single one. It's not really different from Southern style, but it's almost like an add-on to your Southern style tag. You'll have a lengthy face and peril segment. Somebody will tag out, get the hot tag. The guy will come in, start cleaning house, maybe even have almost like a second babyface shine segment to a degree, and then suddenly he'll get hit with the clothesline and he'll be your face and peril for 5 minutes. And when you first watch it, not that that was never done. I mean, you can watch Rock and Roll Express matches and that happens. But with the AWA, it's almost every tag match is like that, particularly in the early portions. And when you first watch it, it seems like this weird quirk. But the more you watch it, the more you sort of appreciate it as a regional spin on a obviously excellent formula. So
and another staple they use. Is that in a lot of matches you will see the heel will keep the face isolated on the floor.
Yeah.
During the heat section. That happens probably a good 75-80% of the matches.
Yes.
So that's another quirk of the promotion.
Let me add to that not only does that happen, but regardless of the size of the heel or the reputation of the heel, they always sell for the baby faces. Does not matter that Animal and Hawk are 280 pounds, they're going to sell for 150-pound Vern Gagne. It's going to happen. Am I joking? I mean,
no, you're right.
Crusher Blackwell, 400 pounds, bumping like a fucking pinball, for whoever the face is.
Yeah.
You know.
I've been going to suggest that perhaps the multiple face and peril segments are due to Vern trying to reflect the variations in the success of his promotion.
I have no clue how that came about. And like I said, when I first started watching the footage, I thought it was really, really strange. But I actually think it adds to a lot of those matches. And going a little bit farther, I'm just going to throw this out here. I think people are going to be really surprised by how good the High Flyers were as a team. I think that's going to shock people because I think, as a rule, the sort of general assumption has been Greg Gagne sucks. The only reason he ever did anything in the business is because of who his dad was. And Jim Brunzell was like, the best worker in the fifth best WWF tag team from the 80s. Like, that's sort of the extent of the discussion of those guys. But they were not only were they big draws. I mean, that's not really pertinent to what we're discussing, but they were also a really good team in the ring. I mean, they had a lot of really good matches. They had matches that were good that didn't even quite make the set. But I mean, just the stuff they've got that made the set is really, really good. And I think people are going to be surprised by how good they are. I don't know that you're not going to mistake the High Flyers for the Rock and Roll Express or the Midnights. I don't want to oversell this. But they are easily a very good tag team. I have absolutely no problem throwing that designation on them, and I don't think Chris or Will would disagree with me on that.
No, shockingly good. Shockingly good. One, because of, my memories of Greg Gagne as a joke. When I watched AWA in the 80s, because I'm that old, I thought the guy was a joke. I thought it was a joke that this guy – I probably at the time didn't even know Vern Gagne owned the AWA. I just thought it was a joke that, this guy was on TV. But that was late 80s, when I was watching AWA on TV. But, I had that, preconceived notion of this guy all these years. So, come back 25 years later and say, oh, wow, this guy is not bad at all. It was a real revelation. And Jim Brunzell, just the guy that, I associated with the Killer Bees, just like anyone else, and again, another really good wrestler for the time period.
Do you think people will watch this and look at the Killer Bees really as kind of being almost an afterthought to his work as a part of the High Flyers?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I
guess we have to go rewatch all the Killer Bee matches that made tape for the WWF Part 2 80 set.
That is a fair point, but I mean there is stuff like I'm just going to throw this match out here because I mean we're going to get into particulars of matches obviously as this goes along, but there is a match with the High Flyers against Martel and Tito Santana before they were even Strike Force. You know, back in 82, I think. That is, like, holy shit great. Like, you watch and you're like, that's one of the best tag matches I can remember seeing, you know?
Agreed.
And it is, you know, and there are a lot of matches like that on this set. I mean, that's one of the things, to me, the biggest revelation about this set. It's not any particular wrestler. It's not anybody that was better than I thought, anybody that was worse than I thought. It's not that Vern's a dumbass in terms of how he promoted. It's none of that. The biggest revelation of this set to me is just how many excellent AWA matches there were. It's one thing to say, oh, well, there's like, you know, you got a lot of great matches because you watched everything. Of course, there's a lot of great stuff. But there's a lot of excellent stuff, including stuff that really hardly anybody has ever seen. Virtually no one before this set, outside of your most diehard AWA fans, have seen a lot of this stuff. This is, I think, really uncharted territory for a lot of people.
Which that diehard AWA fans would equate to one guy, and his name is
K-Hawk.
K-Hawk, yeah. We got to praise K-Hawk. We've already done the show for about 20 minutes. Without K-Hawk, this set would not exist. It would be part of AWA. I honestly believe that without K-Hawk supplying footage, this set would be part of the territory set where, like, you know, 10 matches would end up on the set kind of thing.
And not only that, I'll take it farther because it's not just the footage. I mean, that's obviously the big deal because it's integral to a set like this, but just his knowledge of the promotion and the angles, the storylines, important promos, like, gives you a big, I mean, as I was going through, you know, he was kind enough to send me some notes and other things that he had that sort of helped me understand certain things that were going on in the feud, which also helped me with my, you know, ridiculous Jerry Reese Blackwell and Ken Patera research project, if you will. But, you know, honestly, K-Hawk deserves as much or more credit than any of us because he chronicled this promotion for years. And the vast, vast, vast majority of the stuff that we have that we were able to get, particularly the stuff that is really difficult to find or obscure, is stuff we got from him. So,
agreed.
Absolutely.
The thing about the High Flyers, I want to get back to that real quick, is, you know, the stuff we have, there is, you know, we had just a little bit. We don't have a lot of the matches in full, which is a shame. You know, especially the East-West feud, which was their best feud. So we have very little of that stuff. But what we do have will definitely, you know, shine a new light on Greg Gagne. And, you know, you talk about, you know, Greg Gagne when you first saw him. When I first saw Greg Gagne was on the video where he – it was on ESPN where he was training with Sergeant Slaughter in the camouflage.
will be an extra.
That's a definite extra on the set. You know, and I was like, who is this geek? And then, you know, you learn, you know, that's Vern's son, blah, blah, blah. And over the years on the internet, he has had, you know, the reputation he has. And that's going to change with this set, along with the, you know, the talking points about AWA as a whole, and that is slow and plodding and full of old guys and, you know, boring and all this other stuff. People will definitely need to check this out to see, you know, what was really going on.
Yep.
Because there was a lot of stuff going on, a lot of, you know, good matches, with a lot of, you know, with some good young talent at the top. So people, you know, they definitely need to check this set out for that reason.
Yeah, it's not a throwaway set from everything I can see from the list here. It's like, it was put together for a reason.
Yeah.
Were you yawning? I mean, were you yawning in the middle of this show?
No, I was switching to a charged phone.
Dave was actually eating a granola bar then. We have to stick with the consistent jokes here, Will. I'm disappointed you got to drag that over.
Okay. A yawn does not sound like a munch. I'm just saying.
I'm actually low on granola bars, and I'm going to go with a pastry here, so...
Sounded like he was yelling. He's like, AWA, I want to talk more about Montreal, you know.
we'll do a show on that eventually, so.
fucking Canadian.
But yeah, like, Will, you would not be putting together a set and putting it out if you didn't think it was well worth watching.
No, not at all. And if I didn't trust these guys to select matches, I would have told him, I said, guys, come on, 150 matches, this could easily be 125 or 100. But the more I watched from it, I was like, no, you know, 150 seems completely valid, you know. Some of the matches we disagreed about, you know, whether we used personal picks or someone got outvoted. But for the most part, you know, I'm very happy with the selection, you know. So
I thought there was pretty close to consensus opinion on the vast majority. I mean, even the matches where there was disagreement, there was really at no point were any of us really going to the wall and fighting over whether or not something should not be on the set, with one notable exception. But I think for the most part, it was almost shocking how much consensus there was. But I think that also just speaks to how good the best stuff on this set was and how interesting the other, you know, even if you don't think that something like Leon White and Jesse Hernandez versus Buddy Rose and Doug Summers is a top 50 match, well, I don't think anybody's necessarily going to have that in their top 50, but it's an extremely interesting match. And there's a lot of that, you know, out there that even didn't make the cut. But I think the vast majority, I mean, I'll be honest with you. You compare this set, you can compare this set in a lot of ways to previous sets. And I think, you know, if you look at it next to Texas, me personally as a fan, I love the Texas set. I enjoyed watching it. And I enjoyed a lot of the stuff on it, especially the storylines and angle-driven stuff. Things like Kerry versus Michael Hayes in the cage, Lou Leave Town, which is an awesome match, especially for a match that short. But you compare those that set to this set, and I really feel like the best stuff on the AWA is there's more of it. There's more depth. I don't necessarily think that makes it a better set because, you know, you do have – you have to weigh pros and cons, but both of them are perfectly worthwhile sets. It's just in terms of the depth for the really high-end stuff, I think the AWA is shockingly deep. You know, that to me was – a major theme. When I was looking at the whole list the other day, I was like well into the 50s before I got to a match that I thought wasn't really, 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 really awesome. You know, and that's a testament to it.
Well, now to be fair, and I want to make kind of a comparison between Texas and the AWA. When you look at the Texas set, the Freebirds, the Von Erichs, Gino and Chris, the dynamic duo, Eric Embry in 89. You have these characters that people give a shit about in the sense that they genuinely cared if the Freebirds or Von Erichs won a match. They cared. They wanted to see Gino and Chris get their due, you know, and get their head shaved, and, you know, before Gino died. And the deaths make up a huge part of the tale.
It would be rather
morbid
if they were wanting that after Gino died, I think. But
they wanted him to shave his head. No, I'm not going to make those jokes. But the point is that the AWA, I think, has a bigger obstacle to overcome in the sense that I don't think, besides my good buddy K-Hawk, anybody gives a shit about the High Flyers. And I think it's a tragedy, and I think that's what this set will fix. But, like, Nick Bockwinkel is a guy that is begrudgingly given respect as a great wrestler, but nobody cares about Nick Bockwinkel the way they care about Ric Flair. Like I could see a kid in the 80s having a Ric Flair poster on their wall. I cannot see a kid in the 80s having a Nick Bockwinkel poster. Or in the 70s or the 60s, because the guy was fucking old back then, too. You know, but you know what I mean? It's like... This territory that you're going to come away appreciating everybody more now. But back then, you know, I don't know if I mean, there are moments where obviously you're going to see the fans care. The fans care passionately about the product. I'm just saying that, like, internet fans.
I don't think anyone cares
internet-wise about any of these guys, and this set's going to change their mind that way.
I agree with
I guess one of the questions I'd like to ask is, at any point does Nick Bockwinkel or Greg Gagne do a kiss any audience members giving full-on tongue? Like Carrie Von Erich.
Yeah, maybe that 80-year-old grandmother in the front row. Yeah.
Well, the big thing about AWA is you got to remember, you know, in the latter half of the decade, if they taped pretty much all their TV in Vegas, where they didn't run house shows in Vegas. I mean, that when they ran Vegas, it was just TV tapings alone. Now we have some stuff from, you know, St. Paul from that era. And, you know, we have Winnipeg up to January 86. But those crowds were definitely hotter than the Vegas crowds. Vegas crowds had their moments. But the Vegas crowds was, you know, just a bunch of people that hang around the casino. And then you got guys like Mike Tenay and that crew. But the crowds are different. And you cannot compare the crowds from AWA to any promotion really in the 80s. Because every promotion in the 80s had their key areas where they had their house and matches and their TV and stuff like that. But AWA,
now,
you know, mainly Vegas.
Now, to be fair, a lot of the house show matches from, like, 80 through 84 are fucking hot. In fact, Dylan
exactly.
will tell you that one of the matches ends in a fucking riot. Well, I'm not going to – don't ruin it. Don't ruin the match yet. Don't let people discover it. But one of the matches ends in a fucking riot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so AWA fans were hot. Don't get me wrong. I'm just talking about internet fans, like, not having a romantic view of the AWA.
Yeah, I agree with Will. I mean, there's no vested interest in a lot of these guys, which I actually think makes this an interesting set on another level, because I think one of the things, you know, with previous sets, I think when it came time to pick your number one, a lot of people said, all right, there's four or five matches that I think are really great, but this match had the biggest impact on storyline. Or this match had a really great post-match. Or, you know, something like that. Like Killer Khan versus Gordy from Texas. Not that that wasn't – I mean, that was in my top three. So it's not like
But it had that iconic moment at the end.
That's right. And I think what's sort of oddly unique about the AWA set, and I don't know that any other set is going to be like this, really, other than maybe other territories when we get to it, is there's no single match that really encapsulates a moment quite like that, and yet I don't think the set is weaker for it. You know, on the surface, that would make it seem like the set is weaker for it, but in a way, I think it is almost liberating because you get matches like Wahoo versus Nick Bockwinkel from 1983, which really, on another set, I mean, it's a great match no matter what context. But on another set, you might say, well, it's a great match, but it's a totally standalone match. In this set and in this environment, it really feels like one of the best things you've ever fucking seen.
And that's because on another set, it might have hurt it from becoming the number one match, but it would be the number two match or the number three match.
Absolutely.
Whereas on this set, because you don't have the emotional investment, unless you're K-Hawk, of course, then this set, you're going to say, well, it's just the best fucking match I've seen this year, and it's the best match I've seen from either guy ever, so fuck it, it's going to go on, you know?
Yeah. One of many matches that I think will be unbelievable surprise to people. And that, by the way, is a match that I've never seen anybody talk about ever anywhere before. Never.
No, agreed. It was completely fucking random. Dylan nominated it. I watched it. And the next day, I had a copy sent to Phil Schneider. I was like, Phil, are my eyes playing with me? Is this not one of the greatest fucking matches you've ever seen? And Phil fucking, once he got it, he's like, yeah, that's going on the next Schneider Cup ASAP. You know, really shockingly great match.
I can't wait to see it. So.
Now, Now, Dylan opened up this can of worms. I want to explore it, okay? And I want to kind of ask you, Musgrave. Musgrave, are you a Bruiser Brody fan?
Answer
honestly, motherfucker.
Brody, I'm not
Come on, you Canadian.
Yes, I am.
I knew you were. I fucking knew it. Christ. Tell him about the debated match there, Dylan.
I would just say, you know, there were matches we disagreed on. I did not like the Wahoo Manny strap match as much as the other guys, but everybody else liked it, so it was what it was, you know. And I think there's probably some matches that I liked a little bit more than other people did. But the one really contentious, I mean, honestly, when we ran down this, everybody, well, as we're going through the matches, we're just saying, yeah, we agree with that. Oh, maybe I don't like that quite as much, but it should be on the set. I mean, that's basically how it went. It was very agreeable after we'd gone through the nominating process. And we finally, it was time to debate whether or not and what Bruiser Brody versus Jerry Blackwell match we were going to have on the set. And that was really the only real contentious moment, because Will really, really hates Brody. I really hate Brody. And Chris, I don't think he's a
Chris is, No. Chris is responsible for more Bruiser Brody matches being on the 80s project than any other person who has voted. I'm just saying.
Well, Chris,
him defend himself. You're a Brody fan, Chris. Live, own it, motherfucker. You're a Brody fan.
I'm not a Brody hater, but I'm not a Brody fan. I'm in the middle.
There cannot be a middle with this motherfucker, because either you accept that he sucks like Dylan and I do, or you have this blind love for this guy that cannot be comprehended. There's no in between.
Well, now hold on, because I will say that this is an area where the intervention of K-Hawk, I think, made a lot of sense, because K-Hawk did say that he believed, as a fan of the product, that at least one of the matches should make the set. And I felt the same way, even as somebody who doesn't like Brody, that at least one of these matches should have made the set, you know, and one of them did. And I feel like it was the best of their matches. And actually, I think we all might. I think Chris is kind of on that, but I think we all basically feel that at minimum it's, you know, a good match involving both of those guys.
Yeah, sure.
And it's not
almost
it's not
entirely all due to Bat Blackwell, right? But yeah.
Look, if we're gonna, you know what? Screw this discussion. If we're gonna, I mean, Brody's on this set, you know what? Once, like,
yeah,
Jerry Blackwell was on the set 20 times. Okay, and I'm gonna say this right now. I think if you were comparing, I'm gonna, this is sort of a weird comparison, but if you were comparing the guys who were on the AWA set to the guys who were on the New Japan set, which was my first set that I participated in as a voter and a viewer. But I would say that Jerry Blackwell is sort of like the Hoshino of this set. Maybe some people who were diehard fans of New Japan knew who he was and appreciated him. And I mean, he was a bigger star there than Hoshino was in New Japan. But I don't think he was a guy. He sort of always had a very minimal reputation. The people who did know about him online were like, oh, he's great, but that's sort of it. Nobody was really talking about him. This set is going to have a lot of people talking about Jerry Blackwell, because he is awfully good in a lot of different situations, you know, both as a babyface, as a heel, as a guy who's bringing the big offense, as a guy who's bumping all over the place. I mean, he's a great promo. He's just a really, really good wrestler. And I honestly think he's kind of the guy who people are going to, when it's all said and done, well, Bockwinkel already has a reputation as an all-time great, even if, like Will said, it's sort of a begrudging reputation. Kurt Hennig, I think he's going to be, you know, a sort of a revelation in the sense that if you're down on his Mr. Perfect work like I was, this set really shows you how great he was. But Blackwell sort of is the guy that comes out of left field, or at least that's how I feel.
I don't think he's as far under the radar as Hoshino was. I think he's more like Kimura. Yeah. Like Kimura, you know, Kimura had all of these matches that, you know, internet fans have kind of said, okay, you need to watch that match whatever. And he was Fujinami's tag partner. And so he was a guy that, you know, probably had more pub than Hoshino, you know, but then when you watch him, you're like, holy shit, Kimura could be a top 20 guy in the world in the 80s, you know? And I think Blackwell come out like that. Whereas Hoshino, it's like, I wish there was more footage. Now, I wish there was more Blackwell footage, but we have a lot of Blackwell footage. Whereas with Hoshino, we're still like, fuck, I need more Hoshino matches. Whereas, you know, after you watch Blackwell and you say, you're going to want, say, I want more Blackwell in my life, but I don't think any of us came away from the project saying we need more Blackwell matches on tape. K-Hawk has an 8-disc Jerry Blackwell comp out there.
Yeah.
So, you know.
That's great.
But,
and this is the best of Blackwell we'll see. You know, I mean, because he's not, he may show up with some St. Louis, and he may show up when we get to random stuff like working the Georgia stuff, Georgia Indies in 88. But this is going to be, you know, this is it for Blackwell. This is his shining moment right here.
Yeah, sure.
Where he's going to, fans will definitely get their chance to see how great this guy was for his size to be able to move around like he did, his selling, his bumping, his offense, his brawling. I mean, the guy, and his promos, we're going to have his promos on there. And the guy was a strong, I mean, he could have been a guy that Vince pushed, you know, as a Hogan opponent. And there was talks of that, you know, happening at the time. But
he go into WWF and just, he thought the whole, he did one of those days, I guess, where they were doing these, like, factory process interview segments where everyone was just in a line and going through. And he basically said, fuck this place, and left.
Yeah.
I have been sort of certified as the world's biggest Blackwell mark, which is kind of funny because while I am a fan of the guy, I'm not nearly as big a fan, I think, as people think. But I will say that he is definitely...
Well, but without a doubt, hold on, without a doubt, you have written more about Jerry Blackwell than he is on Earth.
Now, that is true. But I will say, look, he's underappreciated. I mean, like, anybody who's followed my obsession with Jerry Blackwell as sort of an underrated star of the 80s, this didn't come because I was like, I watched the Jerry Blackwell match, and I was like, wow, a fat guy who does a drop kick, you know, that's awesome. This came because watched a ton of AWA footage, and I actually asked K-Hawk, I said, am I crazy, or is this guy a lot bigger star than people have given him credit for? Is this guy a lot better than people have given credit for? And then I was like, oh, let me investigate this further after he confirmed it. And if you really go through and look at the match results and watch the TV like I did and watch the angles, it's pretty clear that Jerry Blackwell, from late 1979 when he came into the AWA, through the middle of 85 when business really started to tank, was one of the two or three most important guys in that company. And that was a very hot period for that company. So, and more importantly to this topic, he was one of the probably two or three best in-ring wrestlers during that period too in that company. So you're really, you know, he's a guy who's obviously going to stand out. And I think people are going to be really pleasantly surprised if they don't know much or haven't seen much of him. You know, maybe I've helped to enhance his reputation a little bit in the last year. Who knows? But I don't think that until this set, people have really had a chance to watch him. And now they'll have a chance to watch him.
Yeah.
And you were doing that while watching this set, you know?
Yes. That's how that started. I mean, that wasn't, it was totally an organic thing. It's not like I went out of my way to pick a random wrestler and try and lobby for him to be, you know.
Not that you're above that by any means, but.
But it's not like Dylan went out of his way and picked a random dead guy whose reputation preceded him as being this great wrestler, and then, oh, shit, we actually have all the footage from All Japan, New Japan, AWA, Texas, St. Louis, to realize, oh, man, that guy really wasn't that good. That's not Blackwell. That's Brody. That's Brody. See, the book needs to be written on Brody. Hey, this guy wasn't that good. He was a great self-promoter who's a very selfish guy who had a great look. Not the greatest look, but a great look, because I take that duel over him. But
we'll say this for Brody, as I always say when Brody comes up. the reason I think the thing that most disappointed me about Brody over the years, and then I'm bookmarking this conversation. I don't want to hear any more fucking Brody on this podcast after this. But the one thing about Brody is, I always pissed me off, even as a kid. The guy would expend so much more energy on his fucking entrance than he would once he got in the ring. He's like swinging the chain, knocking people over, trying to fight fans. You think this is going to be awesome. Then he gets in the ring, throws some weak-looking punches, meanders around, doesn't do shit.
No sells, fucking chair shots, and fucking just cuts his head randomly, like after like a turnbuckle blow. Fucking sits in a headlock for 6 minutes and then does a knee drop and sells his knees.
Will, I think we do have to give some credit. He did do some pretty good selling in the end.
Oh, fuck. Leave it to Dave for the completely inappropriate joke that I love. Fucking keep doing it, Dave.
Okay, I'm gonna direct Dave to throw another question to the panel here after this.
Okay. I guess one of the things I'd like to ask about is
fucked up, man.
You know, I mean, people think of the AWA as, I mean, obviously it was on, you know, on its deathbed. Oh, sorry, bad segue. Deathbed at the end of the 80s. But, you know, quality-wise, what was some of the stuff like coming out of that time? I mean, certainly, you know, you look at Lawler as a big part of it then. And, you know, what kind of, how was the feel of the product at that point?
At which point?
The dying days.
Late 80s, probably 87 on.
Well, yeah, Kurt Hennig came into his own at that time as a champion.
Yeah.
He was an awesome heel champion. Awesome. Just flat-out awesome. And then you had Wahoo came in, and he added to it the product a lot. Manny Fernandez came in, and their feud, you know, sparked some really great matches. Then you had Bad Company. You know, they came on strong at that time, so they were bringing in a different style to the tag matches. Destruction Crew started late in the process, and their best stuff actually happened after the set in 90.
And just for those who don't know, the Destruction Crew is Enos and Blue.
Yeah.
You could see where they were going. Yeah, I mean.
How about Bad Company?
It wasn't as strong, but it was you know, there was some good stuff from that era.
How does Bad Company come off?
They added a flashy heel style. Pat Tanaka was, you know, just tremendous, and you know what he did. And they had the image, they had DDP and the Diamond Doll. I mean, they had this image that you didn't really see, but they were the new 80s.
And Lee Marshall was their biggest fan.
Yeah, Lee Marshall was their biggest fan, which sparked an announcer feud between Lee Marshall and Larry Nelson. So.
Yeah. Can I jump in here and talk about this period from, like, 86 to 89? Because I was actually watching that period as it unfolded. And, you know, what you find in this period is that, like, if you're a Shawn Michaels fan and you want to argue that Shawn Michaels is great, his time in the or you want to argue that the Rockers are a great tag team, this set's going to absolutely help his case. You know, this is one of those things where, like, Shawn Michaels is a guy that is, you know, opinion on this guy is severely divided on, right, on the internet, right?
Yep.
These Rockers matches will help Shawn Michaels' case. It will help the case that the Rockers were one of the great tag teams in the 80s. You know, Kurt Hennig, Chris said that he thought he came in as a heel. Kurt Hennig was a good heel. Kurt Hennig, as he kind of displayed before his heel turn, was a better baby face. And you're going to see that in Portland as well. Kurt Hennig should have been a baby face. It should have stayed a baby face. I know we would have gotten the Mr. Perfect character, but he was such a great wrestler as a baby face. And then what you see, if you look at the names at the end of the decade, you know, your Wahoos, your Mannies, Jerry Lawler, Kerry Von Erich, Larry Zbysko. I mean, you know, right now as like a smart internet nerd fan who goes back and collects all of this past footage of these guys, I'm loving it. You know, I'm loving the fact that Wahoo's there and Manny's there. But it's clearly after the peak of every guy. Like, none of these guys who are there at the end are there at their very top peak. Wahoo is on the way down.
Just two other guys I forgot. Adrian Adonis and Bob Orton Jr., while they weren't there for long,
But clearly after their peak, though.
But boy, you know, did they have a great match for the Midnight Rockers.
Yeah. You know, but that's what you find, though. You find these guys who are coming to the AWA at the end of, you know, after their peak. Now, guys that peaked in the AWA, you got to go back to the middle of the decade. You got to look at guys like Rick Martel, who, you know, it'd be fair he say he peaked there, right? Kurt Hennig probably peaked as a wrestler in the AWA.
Yes.
Nick Bockwinkel, we don't really know when Nick Bockwinkel's peak was, because he was so old when footage started, you know, making the rounds. But sometime in the AWA. Jerry Blackwell in peak, the, you know, AWA. There. You know, AWA. That last few years, it's kind of a bummer, man, because, you know, we talked about the Greg Gagne as Rambo. I had mentioned this on another podcast, and this was just bad booking, bad foresight, nepotism, whatever. If you put, really, in the 80s, Rambo was hot, man. You know, action figures, cartoons, you know, Rambo was hot. Just like G.I. Joes were hot and Sergeant Slaughter coming out with the G.I. Joe insignia was hot. If you put someone with more credibility in that Rambo skit, it's fucking getting over. And people are buying that shit. Instead, you put Greg Gagne with it. And it's like, oh, fuck. Really, that guy? That's who, you know, I mean, never mind putting Greg Gagne against roided up wrestlers. Now put him up against roided up Hollywood stars like Stallone and Schwarzenegger at the time. And you're thinking, oh, no way. Come on. You know, anybody else.
I can't picture Greg Gagne taking on a Predator. So
Exactly. But you could picture Jesse Ventura doing it. You could picture Hulk Hogan, you know, as what was his name in the Rocky movie? Lips, like Thunderlips. You know,
there was one guy around that could have done it, although his, you know, working ability sucked at the time. Scott Hall.
Sure, but that's what I'm saying. You could have put Scott Hall there. You could have put Kurt Hennig as a babyface in that Rambo get up. And people would have taken it credibly, you know. Oh, fuck yeah, you know, Kurt Hennig. You know, oh, he's going to war. Better buy the ticket for that.
The ball in that is it was, you know, at that time when he was putting the screws to Sarge, because he wanted a piece of the money that Sarge was getting in from his merchandising for G.I. Joe and stuff, and that's why Sarge left.
Yep.
When he did. And Sarge didn't come back for 2 years. So,
yeah.
If Byrne would have been an ass, and let Sarge, you know, keep his money that he got on his own, then there's no telling what they could have done with that, with Sarge as a, you know, that type of character and having underlings and whatever.
Here's where I'm going to step in, because although Chris Zellner is the king of wrestling, of dates and figures and cards and shit like that. I mean, Chris is a lot better at that than I am. But as a rule, I've looked at these AWA results and things like that so much over the last year that it's actually pretty pathetic. And I would break the AWA up into the 80s up into really, I would say, three different sections. You've got 80 to, say, the middle of 84, where you've still got a lot of the old guys around, but a lot of them are better than you think. Like a guy like Mad Dog Vachon was actually pretty entertaining on this set. Like you would expect him to be good, but he was actually pretty good. That's sort of this. I mean, the promotion was still really hot even after Hogan left. That's a bullshit lie. The whole after Hogan left, it all knows that. That's a lie. They did some of their biggest figures after Hogan left. You know, they that period was really hot. You do see a lot of hot crowds. You see some more feud-oriented stuff in the traditional sense. You see a lot of the guys you would commonly associate with the AWA, Crusher, Bockwinkel, Jerry Blackwell, Mad Dog Vachon, Vern and Greg, you know, that kind of thing. And then I would say you look at
middle of 84 through 85 is sort of like this weird transition period where the company's starting to go downhill, but it's a slow descent. It's not like they immediately, like all of a sudden they're running the showboat right away and there's, you know, 150 fans there. It's a very slow, gradual descent. That's when you got your Pro Wrestling USA connection going on. You've got Martel getting the title. You've got sort of the this weird yes, the Freebirds come in. The Road Warriors are there. Slaughter's brought in. Blackwell becomes the top babyface in the middle of 84 and then goes out to sell an injury and business tanks, and then business magically comes back up whenever he comes back on the shows, but we're supposed to believe Blackwell isn't a draw if you ask some people at certain websites, whatever. So anyway, all this goes down in this period. By the end of 85, you've got Vince has fully come in, and things are looking really bleak. They hardly do any other major really successful shows after 85. I mean, there's a good show in Salt Lake City, a good show Wrestle Rock, there's a few others, but 86 till the end, I would almost lump in as one whole group, because what you've got at 86 at the to the end is you've got this, like Chris described it earlier, it's a potpourri of stuff. You know, you've got, Will said it, you've got guys who are on the down end of their career coming in and having surprisingly strong performances. You've got guys who are really young, like young Vader, Leon White, who was just there, you know, really green but having good matches. I mean, you've got the Rockers who are really green, having good matches. It's a weird mismatch of people, people that you wouldn't even think were in the AWA show up. You know, Tommy Rich shows up for a brief period, for example. I mean, there's all this bizarre stuff going on during that whole window of time, all the way to the very end, which is why I really like the idea of Larry Zbyszko versus Nikita Koloff being the last match on the set, because it sort of illustrates how bizarre things got as the promotion went on. But I think one thing people are going to notice if they look at the 150 is, even as that period was such a period of turmoil, 1986 was clearly the year with the most matches, and it had a shitload of really good matches. I mean, 85 and 86, I think, had the two were the matches with the two most the years of the two most matches on the set, and 86 really is a stacked year. I mean, there's just a ton of good stuff in that year from the promotion. And it's actually it makes it even more unfortunate how stupid the booking was and how poor Vern's decision-making was and how poorly they reacted to the Vince stuff. I don't know that it would have made much of a difference, but it really makes it even sadder because the quality of the wrestling was so high, and yet a big part of the reason the AWA has this reputation with Net fans that we keep going back to is because of that period. You know, I mean, like, what do you get behind? You know, it's really this weird situation where their peak year is also arguably their first year where the company was pretty much unsalvageable from a business perspective, you know? So
you got the halfway part through that year, you know, Hansen was champion for the first half of the year, and he was very strong. He had strong matches, you know, he had great gimmick. I mean, he was pretty awesome. And then he left, all right? And in AWA, the one thing that they always did, which sucked, was whenever the title was vacated, it always went back to Bockwinkel.
Yep.
You know, they never had anything, a decision match or anything to determine a champion. They said, let's just give it to Bockwinkel. You know, and when he left, you could just tell that that's when it really started to go down in that time period at that time. Because, like I said, the fans, you know, it's like, shit, you know, this is the same old song and dance. You know, there's other guys, you know, why not have Curt Hennig face Larry Zbyszko for the title, you know, in a decision match? Or why not have other guys? Let's give it right back to Bockwinkel again.
Or even have a decision match.
I totally agree with that, but I just want to throw out one thing real quick. This will be self-serving, but do you know who Stan Hansen's best drawing opponent was?
Well, Nick Bockwinkel.
Actually, Jerry Blackwell. I think one of the biggest mistakes that company made during that period, part of it was Blackwell's health because Vince was going behind their back and calling State Athletic Commission supposedly, and Blackwell had all kinds of other health problems. But Blackwell was so hot after he turned babyface in the middle of 84 after the Battle Royal. And then he goes away. and business tanks. He comes back, magically business goes back up, which we're supposed to believe has nothing to do with that, if you talk to certain people, like I said before. It stays really strong. I mean, they drew like 16,000 or 17,000 for that at the end of the year for a match of Blackwell headlining. So they were not dead at that point. And they did some good gates in the beginning of 85. But it seemed to me like the AWA, you've got these guys, you've got Blackwell, you've got Sarge, you've got Hanson. They had guys who could draw money, but they never put them against each other in the matchups you would really want to see. You know, it's weird because this set is filled with great matches from a perspective of matches, but it's not necessarily the matches that would have drawn money. It's very odd. I don't know. That's another thing that's really unique about this set. We're dancing around another thing too, as we're talking about 86. So I'm just going to throw this on the table. You know, when Dave Meltzer wrote his obituary of Buddy Rose, and Buddy Rose passed away a few years ago, he sort of said that, you know, by the time he got to the AWA, he was still a good worker, but he was clearly past his prime. Did either of you two think Buddy Rose is past his prime in the AWA?
No. Well, I would say this. He was not as physically it sounds weird, right? But he clearly was physically unhealthy.
Yeah.
But as a worker, no. But like, it used to be Buddy was just kind of fat, you know, had no tone to him. Now it was just like obese. But still such a great fucking worker.
Oh, yeah. There are matches. I mean, like, those Rockers matches, like, you know, honestly, I haven't composed my ballot. I didn't do it as we went through it. I'm going to go through and watch everything again from beginning to end. As I'm thinking about matches that would finish in the top tier, there are several of the matches from that feud that are, like, top 10 contenders.
Oh,
not top
yeah.
30, top 10. You know,
and it's not all because of the Rockers. And it's not all because of Buddy Rose either. Doug Summers is his home. Yeah.
I mean, you talk about a guy who had a career year who nobody ever really talks about. Doug Summers, for that run with Buddy as his tag team partner, had such a great run. It's really unbelievable. In fact, here's a little amusing factoid. But Doug Summers actually, for a long time, had more matches on this set than Rick Martel did, like right up to the very end. Martel ended up with one more match than him. But Doug Summers was a guy who was just in so much good stuff during that one-year period. It's really incredible. You know, a true career year. I think if you were to point to, you know, a year in history where a guy really stood out of the pack and then maybe was never as good again or never had a profile like that again, Doug Summers for that year is probably the perfect example in wrestling. I don't know if you could find a better example.
I think it's pretty firmly established after this set being completed, Dylan, that you do wish Doug Summers was your daddy, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Maybe I'll use Doug Summers' project next.
Yeah, I want to bring something back real quick. You know, you talk about Hogan, you know, leaving AWA is when a lot of people say it was died. Heenan leaving AWA had a much bigger impact than Hogan did.
I agree.
Because there was nobody who ever could take his place as a manager. Nobody. They tried everybody. Adnan, DDP, Sherry, you know, they had Medusa. They had different people as managers after Heenan. But nobody could get the heat like Heenan did, and nobody could, you know, work his style as a manager and work as a six-man in a wrestling match as Heenan did. Heenan was a big draw, much bigger than he gets credit for for the AWA.
Absolutely.
And you can tell definitely, you know, how the heel side of things and that promotion totally changed after he left. Totally changed.
Yeah.
Heenan definitely, you know, had a bigger impact in his leaving than Hogan did.
You know, Heenan's one of those guys where, you know, I mean, greatest manager of all time, no one's going to really argue that, you know. Whereas my personal favorite is still Jimmy Hart in Memphis, but God, Heenan was so great. I mean, I'd always said that, not seeing Bobby Heenan in AWA, that, you know, Jimmy Hart, as a guy who has to get over every single character, I'd never seen Heenan in AWA. And now it's much harder for me to argue for Jimmy Hart than it used to be after watching this set.
I think it's 1A, 1B. I mean, I think they're right there together. You can't compare because Hart had a volume of guys that he had to, you know, he managed, while Heenan had, you know, he had a core of guys, and he had a couple of guys here and there.
Yeah.
But they both had their strengths, and they capitalized on them well. So I think they're together.
I'm glad you saved that for me. I'm going to call Hart my 1A. Very good.
Well, yeah.
I 1A, 1B.
I would say this, too. If you're talking about Heenan and you're talking about Jimmy Hart, I think when you look at those two guys, well, really, if you isolate Heenan, you look at him, these two guys are probably the only managers in history, if you exclude Cornette and Smoky Mountain, which was a territory he owned, so I don't think that should really count, they were the only two managers in history who at any point you could really say they were the MVP of the promotion they were in. Because when Lawler was gone, Jimmy Hart was the MVP of Memphis. I mean, he was the necessary component. And Bobby Heenan was, I would argue, the MVP of the AWA.
Oh, hold on. Is somebody listening to the show while Dylan's talking?
Did you hear echo?
Yeah.
I thought I heard somebody's TV on.
Well, I don't hear it now.
I don't either. I think it was one of you bastards learn how to do radio, fucker.
I turned my porn down, so don't worry about that. But
awesome.
All I'm saying is that the AWA, you know, Heenan and Jimmy Hart are unique because they were actually MVPs of their promotions. Like, not good complimentary guys, not guys who added a little bit, not guys who added a lot. When Lawler wasn't around, Hart was the MVP of Memphis. And when Bobby Heenan, I've seen guys like K-Hawk, James Giordani, other people who are AWA experts who agree, Bobby Heenan was the MVP of the AWA from 1980 until the day he left.
He just came back into the territory at the beginning of 80 because he spent most of 79 in Georgia, which he was awesome there as well.
Oh, he's great everywhere.
But,
and most people say his best stuff was in Dick the Bruiser.
Yeah, and Lord Alfred Hayes was the top heel manager while he was gone. So that's where you get the Heenan Hayes feud. It starts from there.
First match on the set, and a very entertaining match at that. I think one of those matches that people are really going to have a lot of fun with if they haven't already seen it, although I don't think it's been a hugely circulated match. It was on WWE 24/7 like 5 years ago. But, so much good stuff on this. On this set is ridiculous, but
yeah. Hey, you know what? I was reading the feedback at DVDVR, and one of the posters there made mention of it, and I think we should address the issue of how many old guys were wrestling in the AWA. And I really, Dylan, I mean, you watched more than most, and Chris, what do you think about that? Whereas, you know, this is clearly a promotion where guys in their late 40s and 50s are wrestling in main event positions, where guys in their 20s and 30s are expected to sell for these guys and treat them with reverence. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm gonna answer very short for once and then give it to Chris.
What?
Because all I want to say to that is, if you look, you know, an exception would be the Crusher, but if you look at, say, Bockwinkel, who's the old guy that really dominates in the 80s, he's there from beginning until 87 when he leaves. I don't have any trouble treating Bockwinkel credibly against anybody, young or old, because he was that good. So,
right.
You know, you could maybe speak differently about some of these other guys, but most of these other guys don't appear on the set that much, and there's a reason why. You know,
Mad Dog Vachon's on there, what, 5 times? I mean,
Mad Dog Vachon is going to be a pleasant surprise. You know, I think people are going to be like, wow, Mad Dog Vachon was really charismatic, and he didn't do a lot, but everything he did meant something and was really entertaining. I mean, that's what I came from watching Mad Dog. And I actually think you feel the same way, Will. I assume Chris does, too. So, anyway, I'll let Chris answer this in more detail if he wants to.
Okay. You know, the deal with older guys is, in the early part, they're not as old, some of them. Like Baron Von Raschke, he's not as old. He's still not very great or anything, but he's not as old. But Vachon,
Bashan's, you know, a guy who you got to take consideration his character and his connection with the fans. Same thing with the Crusher. The Crusher is probably the worst of them all as far as a worker, but the fans loved him to death.
Absolutely.
And, you know, everything he did was credible to them. And you got to put yourself in that position as you're watching this. You got to look at the time, the place, you know, everything that was going on and take that in consideration as far as, you know, how these guys are received. It's kind of like Giant Baba, you know, in his later years, you know. Baba was old and plodding, as it went along, but the young guy still sold for him, you know, and it was credible because of who it was. It was Baba. And the same thing, you get this feeling from Crusher and Bashan. Now, as time goes on, you know, and later in the set, you'll see, in fact, one of our matches we pushed on the set was a match involving, Ray Stevens and Von Raschke and against, was it T.J. Khan and Soldat Yusinov?
Yep.
Okay. Ray Stevens is in his 50s, but Raschke's in his 50s, and Khan and Yusinov both sucked a big one. But that match worked for reasons like that, where these old guys are just spirited as hell. They're out there throwing bombs, and the heels are selling for them, and the crowd was into it. It was at Vegas, you know, and this was in '88.
One other match that really I think of is that Ray Stevens versus Larry Zbyszko match, which actually Chris used a personal pick on.
Yeah.
You know, which I was to me. You know, a match that I almost use a personal pick because it's very short, but you get to see a really interesting, fired up performance by Ray Stevens, who's defending the honor of Nick Bockwinkel. I mean, like it really comes across like, you know, this guy at the Elks Lodge who's going to have it out with somebody who talks shit about his World War II veteran buddy or something. You know, like it's a really good match. You know, and I think the old guys that are there. You know, and in fact, one guy who was specifically mentioned, who's only on the set once, this was actually one of my favorite matches. And I want to distinguish this because it's not going to finish in my top 20, but it was one of my favorite matches on the set, was the Pat O'Connor-Nick Bockwinkel match from '81. I mean, Pat O'Connor was almost 60 years old. That match is a hell of a lot of fun. They're doing almost World of Sportish-style tricked-out mat work and all these crazy exchanges, and the crowd is eating it up. You would have thought Pat O'Connor was the biggest deal in the world. I think that's one thing we have to kind of understand is the three of us on the line, you know, that watch this footage are regional fans who grew up in the South. Dave is a regional fan, you know, who grew up in the Maritimes and now lives in Toronto. The AWA was a regional federation for people in that sort of Great Lakes region. And there are things that, and with certain guys, Crusher is the most obvious, that maybe ain't going to connect for us, but they sure as hell connected for those fans back then. You know, like, it doesn't seem to me as a kid who grew up in South Carolina in the 80s going to show, you know, matches at house shows, to seeing the Rock and Roll Express and the Midnights and Ric Flair, to me it doesn't seem like that big a deal, but it obviously seemed like a big deal at the time. And, you know, I think Mad Dog is really the perfect manifestation on the set of a guy who the connection he has with the crowd really makes his matches better. You know, it really adds a lot to the matches. I think that's going to be – if you're the kind of person who crowd heat really helps or hurts a match to you, those Mad Dog matches are probably going to finish pretty high on your ballot.
You know, you mentioned that about the region. Because I just want to preface this by my grandparents lived in Iowa, okay, along the Mississippi River. And they used to play bridge and pinochle, you know, whatever night, Saturday nights, you know, that's what they did, right? They joined a couple of other couples. And one of the couples, my uncle was telling me the story, you know, a couple of years ago. I just had a laugh. He was saying, you know, one of the couples, I forget their names, he remembered their names. He said that when they came over, that, you know, that my grandfather better put it on professional wrestling so they could watch their wrestling while they're playing bridge. Because if not, they were taking their cards and going home because they were not going to miss professional. And it would have been like the AWA. I mean, we're talking like whatever was playing in the Iowa, Illinois region in the 60s, right? That would have been AWA, right?
That would have been AWA in the 60s?
States.
Yeah, it's an AWA in the 60s. Or St. Louis may have got up there.
Okay.
It would have been AWA. Yeah, it would
but, you know, and God forbid there was like a football game or something that my grandfather wanted to watch because he said that, you know, some weeks, you know, as long as the wrestling was on, that they were perfectly behaved and that, man, you take off their wrestling because, you know, of a football game, a Bears game or a Packers game or, you know, some college Hawkeye game, boy, they would steam and just, you know, boil up and say, oh, we're leaving. We got to go watch our wrestling. Yeah,
but I think AWA aired on Sundays back in the day. So you know, that'd be like before the football games. That'd be your perfect pregame show: wrestling, then watch the Bears.
Yeah,
Packers.
I'm sure Will's grandparents started partying Saturday night and kept going through to Monday morning. So
yeah, it could have been. Man, I don't know. This is a story my uncle told me. Man, I just thought it was just hilarious because you know. It's like us in the 90s, you know, hey, it's Monday night. I'm watching some Monday Night Wars. You know, so I'm going home or I'm going to a buddy's house who has wrestling on.
It was a cultural thing, sure. I think that's really important to understand. And by the way, I'm not saying that you're not going to be able to enjoy this if you don't put yourself in that mindset. I think that's actually the farthest thing from the truth possible because none of us are in that fucking mindset, and we all enjoy
right.
this stuff. So, I just think when you're talking specifically about the old guys, you kind of have to look at it that way. You can't look at it any other way because it's just the way it was. I mean, they were on top for a reason. Maybe they stayed on top too long. Well, certainly in some cases they stayed on top too long. But overall, I really don't feel like they were a huge detriment to the product, to the fans at the time, or looking back now. I think a lot of the stuff
sure.
was really, really good. So.
It sounds like they were out there trying to help business too, right? Like they weren't
absolutely.
Just trying to hang on. They were out there trying to sell programs. So.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at a guy like Crusher, the Crusher drew so much money in Milwaukee, especially. Vern would have been a friggin' idiot not to try and use him as long as he could. I mean,
hell, Vince was using the Crusher in '87.
Yeah.
You know, in special matches, for God's sake.
The Crusher in Milwaukee, if you go back and look at the figures, and we don't even have full attendance figures from that period, but if you go back and look at the figures from his height, it's frightening. I mean, like, because Milwaukee was always a good town for them, but the building they ran in the 80s was about a 6,000 to 7,000 seat building, and they would sell it out often. But when Crusher was in his prime, they were selling out a 10,000 seat building in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to look at it that way. 10,000 seats doesn't seem a lot to today's wrestling fan, but on a loop that you're doing weekly, that's a shitload of people weekly. You know, I mean, so you really got to look at it from that context and look at it that way when you're talking about overall impact to the promotion.
But did he sell the leg? Did he sell the leg, Dylan? That's the important question here.
Well, that really is the age-old question, I guess. And Crusher was not known for selling, so. Crusher was like Ole Anderson, you know, he was just coming forward at all times. Although, Crusher dressed up as one of the fabulous ones is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in wrestling.
And that is an extra.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen anything funnier than that in wrestling, so.
Baron von Raschke and drag.
Yeah, that might be up there, but. Okay, I'm
going to... Hey, hold on. Right before you... I want to mention this, too, for the extras. People who are familiar with these sets, this set is not getting a Memphis or Texas extra makeover. It's going to be closer to, like, Mid-South, maybe a disc or two of extras. And we're kind of limiting the extras to memorable moments. And I just want people to know that. One, so I can get the set out quicker. But two, my buddy K-Hawk... who's kind of like supplied everybody with AWA footage has done such a great job of cataloging particular feuds of AWA moments that I want to make sure that this set doesn't like kill K-Hawk off dead. You know, hey, if you want to explore AWA more, that you go to my buddy K-Hawk and he'll get you all the footage you need. So,
And I mean, there's a ton of stuff he's got that I would recommend. Both documenting feuds, years, individual wrestlers, even like he's got a disc of just the great promos. He's got a disc of just the great promos in the AWA in the 80s, which we couldn't include all of them if we wanted to. And I mean, you know, that would be a great compliment to this if somebody wanted to pursue it. It's you know, awesome stuff. So, yeah. But anyway.
Will, you had mentioned at one point doing a 1990 disc as an extra. Is that something you're going to leave to K-Hawk or look at?
You know what? I might just throw that on the 1990 yearbook that I'm working on.
Yeah, that's cool, yeah.
You know, and if you want to look at the 1990 in the fall of AWA, buy the 90 yearbook, you know.
Yep, and I don't think there's a whole lot of it that is going to set anybody's world on fire. There's some good stuff, but it's not the greatest era in the world. Although,
yeah, even AWA extra-wise, it's easier for us anyway. You know, they did not run a lot of angles. So, you know, we don't have a lot, you know, this angle-heavy promotion like a Memphis or a Texas to worry about. We just, you know, we can just pick and choose the best stuff. It's easier.
Yeah. I agree. Wholeheartedly endorse that statement.
So before I interrupted there, what were you going to say, Dylan?
Oh, no, I was going to ask if Dave has any more perverted and or serious questions he wanted to ask.
one serious one that I wanted to ask is, you know, you look at guys like Bockwinkel, Lawler, Hogan, Martel, who are on here, who you might see on a lot on other sets. Well, Hogan you'd see on New Japan, and we'll see him again on WWF. What kind of stuff do you think you see differently out of them in the AWA that you don't see on the other stuff?
Well, with Hogan, you'll see Hogan. I mean, we saw him in New Japan, but you'll see Hogan probably at his best, in his best part of his career.
In the AWA?
Yes, he was so hot. So hot as a babyface. It's sickening. You know, everybody's probably seen that Super Sunday match, the one with Bockwinkel with the, you know, the Phantom title change, but he's had some other matches on there. I mean, the crowd was just nuts for that guy. So I see there's
an Adonis match on there. I bet that's good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Adrian Adonis was probably at his peak at that time too. I mean.
Yeah, for sure.
During the East-West period, absolutely. You know, I think there's a lot of guys like that you're going to see that have maybe popped up on other sets. That you know that you might see a slightly different. I think Bockwinkel is probably the biggest example of a guy that you're going to see differently, only because of the fact that, as Will and I have talked about in other places before, Bockwinkel is kind of, you know, seen as a boring guy. And Will, while watching the All Japan footage, I think did see him as a boring guy himself.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
On this footage, he's not a boring guy. You know, like. He is a tremendously great wrestler. He can brawl. He can work the mat. He can go long. He can work sprints. He's excellent. His tag team with Mr. Saito is one of those great short-lived tag teams. You know, me and Dave did a show on that before. And Bockwinkel and Mr. Saito are one of the all-time great short-lived tag teams, that you wish would have been around longer because they were so good. There's a lot of that. I think Mr. Saito is another guy who's appeared on other sets. People, I think, are going to be surprised by how different he is because he does a lot of chicken shit heel stuff. And
yeah.
In the AWA in New Japan, he's, you know, a badass, right? I mean, he's this burly guy you don't want to mess with. And in the AWA, you got spots where he's running around doing slip on the banana peel spots on the floor while Hogan chases him, you know, begging off in the corner. Like, it's really cool to watch and see how well he does it. I mean, for a guy who was known as a badass, he just sort of seamlessly transitions into this like it's perfectly natural second nature behavior for him. It's not different at all. And I was really impressed with him. And then the other real guy where I would say you see a big difference is Curt Hennig. Because if you see Curt Hennig in the, you know, as Mr. Perfect, which is how a lot of people see him, of course that's not really an 80s, although he was on the original WWF 80s set I think a few times, but if you see him as Mr. Perfect, this set is so different, and you're going to see him both as a great baby face and as a great heel, having great matches with a huge variety of people. You're going to see him as a really stiff wrestler, you know, a guy who throws a nasty shot. I mean, he's got a like a 10-minute long brawl with Stan Hansen from the Showboat. That's like a top 10 level match. I mean, it's really, I mean, they're just beating the hell out of each other. So Kurt Hennig would be the other guy who I would really kind of throw out there as a guy you're going to see in a different light on this set than maybe from other footage that you've seen, if you haven't seen this stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things you talked about before to me, Dylan, is people kind of have the impression with Slaughter that, like, after he turned face in WWF, there was never any real good work from him after that, and that you feel some of his AWA stuff would kind of contradict that idea.
Yeah, I mean, Slaughter ended up having only, I think, like 8 or 9 matches on the set, but Slaughter also had a lot of good TV matches or other matches that just barely missed the cut. But of his he had matches like he had the match with Mr. Saito that didn't make the set, and that's really great, but it's like 3 minutes long. And then, you know, like, but of the matches that made this, I mean, the Hansen matches are all awesome. And the Hansen handheld is really a never-before-seen match. And it is an excellent match. You know, and even earlier in his career, before the WWF, you know, when he was working this, you know, Super Destroyer 2, good stuff
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that's true, too.
I mean, he had a really good match with Boris Zukov, of all people we put on the set from later years. Sarge is definitely, you know, it's not as deep as maybe you would think, but that's mainly because of how he was booked. But the matches he does have on there, his performances are really, really great.
I'll give you one that's a oddball one, kind of in a way, is early Vader, Leon White. You know, his first year as a babyface. I mean, he's a first year guy, and he's having, you know, he has a match with Hansen that's on the set. He had some matches that didn't make the cut. But he was kind of like if for those of you that got the ECW set, there's a good comparison between him and Bubba Ray Dudley and how natural they were in that first year of their career as a babyface. I mean, it's insane to see how good this guy was, and then you know how good he would become later on. Another guy who's going to get a better reputation, I think, come off this set is Colonel DeBeers.
Absolutely, you beat me to it. I was just about to inject that into the conversation.
Before you add Colonel DeBeers, let me just preface that by saying only because AWA is going to come out before Portland.
Yep.
Because Ed Wiskowski, the legend of Ed Wiskowski grows with the more Portland you watch.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, DeBeers' rep isn't even necessarily going to be fully represented on the set because, you know, he had, you know, one match that we left off really because we couldn't get it in the best video quality, which happens. It was, I think, the only match that we sort of, because I don't think Will and Chris liked it quite as much as me, but did that with. But also, he was a great squash wrestler. And obviously, we're not going to have squash matches on this set. But, I mean, he had the most entertaining squashes every time. Like, beating the hell out of guys, then giving him, you know, one or two big bumps to make you think they have a chance, and then just destroying them. But his stuff that has meant, I mean, he was just an excellent bumper, really stiff, you know, his, like, I can't say enough about Colonel DeBeers. I think, you know, he's probably not going to have any one match that really breaks through as a holy shit, this is excellent match from this set. But I think this is a good introduction to a guy that a lot of people don't know about, and it will prepare them for Portland where those matches are going to exist.
Yeah. And another thing, too, is AWA suffers from what almost all 80s promotions in America suffer from. You're going to see some bad finishes on the set, you know, where some of these guys, you might not come out thinking, wow, Colonel DeBeers is really great because – it's like, shit, man, that match was great, but that ending sucked. Or, you know, and we have those on every 80s set. It's just a sign of the times. You know, but hopefully people won't hold that against them too much.
And Dylan talked about the squash matches. You know, we won't probably do this on this run, but I would suggest that Will in the future maybe do a best of the AWA squash matches.
Well, not me. You want to give that to our buddy K-Hawk there.
Yeah, okay. Well, they had squash matches. These jobbers took some punishment in these squash matches. And the best thing about them was the jobbers had they had these personalities.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't normally see from the jobber. So while they're getting the hell beat out of them, you know, they got a little personality to go with it, and the squashes were enjoyable, especially in the later run.
It was weird because you couldn't, like, it's not like, I mean, I'm an obsessive guy who watches everything anyway. If it's on a disc, I'm going to watch it from beginning to end. That's the point of these projects, and also I just can't help it. But, you know, sometimes you're going to be tempted, oh, this squash is terrible. I'll just fast forward through it. AWA, I didn't want to fast forward through the squashes, man. There's a Buddy Rose squash versus this guy Billy Anderson that I almost put on the friggin' set. There's a Colonel DeBeers, Dennis Stamp match that's actually like really good. If it was like 2 minutes longer, I might have put that on the set. You know, so a lot of these guys had even more depth, even at things like squash matches. Yeah, I really, you know, watching the AWA footage was just much. I mean, I'll be honest with you. When Will was like, look, I want to bring you on to the 80s project, how's the AWA sound? I was excited because I like things that are totally different. And I like things that are, you know, I haven't seen a lot of or haven't, you know, watched a million times already. But a part of me was like, oh, shit, this could be, you know, this could be some bad stuff in here. And I was actually blown away by how little of it was really bad. I mean, I've said this before, and you know, tonight I'm gonna you know, post on the Def Leppard Driver board my stop picks for this set to try and kind of kickstart the discussion and get things rolling a little bit before we officially have it out. But it's hard to do a stop going down pick for this set because there's really no one who you watch the footage of and go, man, that guy is nowhere near as good as I thought. I mean, there's nobody like that. The whole set is basically guys who are as good as you thought or even better than you thought. Or it's the situation...
Who would you say were the biggest surprises?
Well, Blackwell was a surprise to me only because I didn't expect him to be as good as he was. I think the Beers would have been a bigger surprise to me if I hadn't seen the Portland. You know, I mean, I think seeing the Portland sort of cheated myself out of being more surprised by the Beers, but I've also watched the footage.
We already mentioned them, but Greg Gagne, easily.
What? That's sure. Probably the answer. Greg Gagne is probably the number one answer. And I would preface that by saying that Doug Summers, who I've always liked, being as good as he was a little surprising. But
sure.
Greg Gagne probably is the best answer to that. I mean, Greg Gagne has 22 matches on this set. And, yeah, he was there from the beginning of the run to the end, so he benefits some from that. But it's not like there was Greg Gagne matches we were trying to get on at the last second. Of all the guys who are on this set, Greg Gagne was like, all his matches are unanimous. We were all like, oh, yeah, this is on.
Yeah.
So he is a really, definitely really the surprise, I think, overall. Am I missing anybody? You guys think of anybody else?
No,
Brad Rangins. You know, we don't have a lot of Brad Rangins because he has injuries, but when he was on, Brad was a strong competitor. You know,
I think he's too inconsistent.
I agree with Chris, actually. I think Rangins
at his best, though, Will, right?
Sure.
At his best, you would think he's pretty good.
Well, I think Rangins was really
was
good in the ring. I think the problem was that he you know, he was very AWA-ish.
Yeah.
Sort of the black. you know,
he's
I think, again, as guys who are from where we are from, a guy with that look and that sort of demeanor isn't necessarily going to resonate that well with us.
No,
but Rangins versus Martel is a great match. I like the Rangins-Bockwinkel match that we put on. It's a studio match I like a whole lot. One of the only studio matches we have because there's not a whole lot of AWA studio footage that wasn't squashes. Rangers is a guy. I agree with Chris on that. He's probably not a guy that anybody's going to go, oh, my God, this is, you know, the unbelievable super worker. But I definitely feel he's better than I thought. I thought he was going to be pretty terrible, and he wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. But actually, I'm going to throw somebody out there. Only because I'm working on other sets, and there's so little footage of them. And that's Wahoo McDaniel.
Yep.
And then the reason I'm going to throw Wahoo out there is, one, because we already talked about the Nick Bockwinkel match, which is probably the best Wahoo McDaniel match on tape, bar none. I can't think of another one. I mean, we had the Houston Wahoo Flair match, which is really great, but I think even people who watch that set would say, no, this one's better. And then he comes back in the late 80s, and it's kind of weird because, like, you had, like, this contingent of myself, Phil Schneider, and Chris, and Eric R., who loved the Wahoo-Manny feud. And Dylan, for whatever reason, is just disconnected from me. He's like, eh, it's okay. Eh, this is all right.
Well, I thought they
had
one really good match. I thought they had one match
right.
I loved.
But what I'm saying, though, is that clearly you were an outlier in the sense that three or four matches from that feud ended up on the set in the final. And, you know, but what I'm saying, though, is that still as late as 1987-88, Wahoo McDaniel is still there battling, bleeding, cuts one of, after the strap match from I think it was Super Clash, cuts one of the best fucking Wahoo McDaniel promos ever. You just got to watch it, and it'll be on the set for sure.
There's
I think I'll
the,
just
I mean,
leave the tape
he had
running.
Kurt Hennig, he had the Kurt Hennig. There was that Kurt Hennig match. I don't like the strap match with Kurt, but the their other match I love. He had the Boris Zukov chain match, which.
Yep.
Has potential to be terrible on paper, but is actually really awesome. And even Wahoo's actually in one of the five matches from 89 that are on the set. It's a tag match, him and Tom Zink versus Zbyszko, and I actually can't remember who the hell his partner was, but it was one of the last matches also that you know, even in 89. So.
Yeah. Manny Fernandez and Zbyszko.
That's who it was. It was Manny and Larry. And that is, you know, so, and actually, there were matches, he had other matches he had in 89. He had a good match with Zbyszko, just had a terrible finish. You know, like, we're talking about bad finishes. I mean, Wahoo definitely goes up, you know, and I think Saito is another one where I don't think, I mean, Saito's a guy whose reputation obviously was helped a lot by New Japan and All Japan. But I think Saito, again, because you're seeing him in a different light, it adds an extra dimension to him as a worker, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that kind of, you know, he becomes even better now.
And I got a guy who, you know, we only had two matches up on the set, but when we watched the television from the time, he looked really strong, especially in the squash matches, and he's underrated because of who his brothers are, but Mondo Guerrero is going to get some looks, you know, come out of this set. Like, wow. This guy.
Yeah, but it was still clearly the fourth Guerrero brother.
Yeah, but they'll tell you this as well. He was probably the best of the bunch.
Mm.
You know, Chavo's. I've heard Chavo say that before. That Mondo was the best. But
I don't. I don't take wrestler opinions seriously. Just saying. Terry Funk wasn't it? Terry Funk who was it? Terry Funk that said. Who did he work with that he said was better than Jumbo?
He said Masato Tanaka was better than any of All Japan.
Yeah, man.
This is brothers talking about brothers. You know, it's not wrestler talking about wrestler. So, you know, you got to say, hey, this guy's the best of the brothers.
Yeah, Chris, I'm not trying to diminish your pick. Well, I am, but, you know, I'm just saying, though, man, you know, Mondo Guerrero stands out in his run in the AWA, but compared to, like, the best of Chavo that we've seen, like, with Olympia, the best of Hector, like, with those tag matches, like, in the UW, just not on the same planet. That's all I'm saying.
We don't have this, you know, the footage, because Mondo didn't work any really prolific territories. He did work Portland for a little while in the mid-'80s. But
I wonder if that'll pop up.
He had a great match with Buddy Rose in 78 for San Francisco, or 77 maybe, I'll tell you that.
Okay,
great
TV
match.
He only wore SoCal Indies, you know, he mainly just stayed close to home.
Oh, okay. Well, then hopefully that'll bear out as we get more 80s footage, you know. We'll find some more Mondo.
Well,
because I think he's on some of that WIN from 1989 too, so.
I think one thing we can do to try and take the heat off Mondo is to discuss this with Will. It's one that I cooked up especially for you, Will. I'll put it in an essay format, but Buck Zumhoff is like a dumber, less cool version of Michael Hayes. Discuss.
See, all right. The rock and roll fucked Zumhoff. All right. When I looked looked at Buck Zumhoff in the 80s, right, you know, I didn't think there was anything cool, because now this is me getting racial. Y'all might get kicked off for the race. But seriously, like, when I thought of, like, the big fucking boom boxes, I thought of breakdancing and black dudes, okay? and you know, seriously, and it's why, like, the Rock and Roll Express, you know, always fucked me up by appearing in concert with who's the racist singer? David Allan Coe. Like, yeah. So it's like seeing Buck Zumhoff with a boombox. I was like, well, is this like some breakdancing gimmick? You know, because in my head, that's what, you know, the boombox was, right? It wasn't something that, like, rock and roll guys had. It was something that, like, you saw on, like, Breaking Two Electric Boogaloo and shit, you know? And
he's certainly much more a trailer park than ghetto, I would think, too. So.
Yeah, yeah. See, and so, you know, to me, like, I mean, like, you just, like, looked at someone like Rock and Roll Buck Zumhoff, right? Now, don't get me wrong. The Rock and Roll Express, because when you're watching it back then, you're comparing it to, like, the Rock and Roll Express, right? But then it gets even worse when you have, like, the Midnight Rockers come out. And those guys looked fucking rock and roll. You know what I mean? Not, you know, I mean, they stood out as a team. And it's like, would I rather cheer for the Midnight Rockers with their high-impact offense and exciting, you know, show around them, or, you know, and the blood and the guts and everything, or am I going to cheer for Rock and Roll Buck Zumhoff? You know what I mean? Who really didn't look that cool.
Two things.
You know?
Actually, three things about
maybe
Buck,
like,
Zumhoff.
the roadie for, like, I don't know, like, what's the fucking, who sang Turn Up the Radio? Who was that?
Queen? No.
Y'all don't remember that song?
Oh, shit.
Turn up the radio.
He could have been a
like,
movie
for
I
could
oh,
see Buck Zumhoff.
Where's Dean when we need him? Dean would know who that was.
Maybe Night Rangers wrote, you know.
Autograph sang Turn on the Radio.
Autograph, yes. Like, he would be like the roadie for Autograph or Helix or, like, one of those 80s bands.
Okay,
you know.
Okay. Let me defend Buck
either
Zumhoff.
Either that or Kearney.
Three things about Buck Zumhoff real quick I want to defend. The first
no,
is
Journey's too cool
not,
for Buck Zumhoff.
Buck Zumhoff was actually pretty decent in the ring. He was. You know, like, he had some good performances. He was actually better than another guy that was better than I expected. Not going to light your world on fire, silly gimmick, but better than I expected in the ring. Number two thing about Buck Zumhoff I'm going to defend, the angle with
not as mustache.
Bobby Heenan smashing his boombox is awesome. I love
yeah.
the angle. I don't care what anybody says. It's one of my favorite angles from the AWA. And finally,
yeah.
another thing I just want to throw out there, one of the funniest things watching this set was Rod Trongar getting excited when he called him Rock and Roller Buck Zumhoff. Like, that was one of my favorite things. Every time he would say it, just
could
die.
Could you imagine Rock and Roll Rambo Zumhoff? Dude, fucking slaughter train. Cut your hair. Fucking.
Well, the one thing that we had to deal with that was tedious was the never-ending Buck Zumhoff School for Eagle series matches. We did put one on the set, the best one, but my God. I mean,
that was the worst. That was the worst thing, and I don't blame Buck for that. I blame Steve Regal.
Steve Regal sucked.
Steve Regal is by far the worst guy in watching the footage, except for guys who you are just terrible, like Kevin Kelly. I mean, but, like, if you take Kevin Kelly out of the equation or guys that were half-trained gooseheads and, like, actually look at guys who were trained pro wrestlers, Steve Regal is easily the worst guy by a lot.
Yeah, he's a spot going down, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, the only guy in the footage where I actually, I mean, I had no opinion of him coming in, and my opinion still went down. Like, that's pretty bad. I had no opinion of the guy, and my opinion still went really down on him. So,
but you know what? Now that you think about it, hold on. Now that you think about it, Jimmy Garvin was awesome. in the Texas set, right?
Yes.
And then he goes to the AWA, okay? And who's his partner?
Steven
Regal. And then in the NWA, I can't find one decent fucking Jimmy Garvin match because his work deteriorated so bad. I'm blaming
actually,
Steve Regal for that.
Steve Regal's the source for everything. He's going down.
What's that?
When he started feeding with Von Raschke, that's when the downward spiral began. And then it was not too long after that when he started teaming with Regal. And that's when Regal.
No, I'm still blaming it on Regal because I like Baron Von Raschke.
I said it started, but then that's when it really kicked in.
Yeah,
you're fucking up my thesis, Chris. I can't accept it.
Regal is definitely, like, let's put it this way. Be glad we did not put more Steve Regal matches on this. I think there's only one. Be glad we did not put more Steve Regal matches on that. I've never seen, I mean, the guy's fucking nickname was Mr. Electricity. He didn't do anything exciting in any match. Like,
no.
I've never seen a more boring wrestler. Like, I can't, it's unbelievable.
Dylan, what energy source would you compare Steve Regal to? I'm just curious.
A rock. something that has absolutely no photosynthetic qualities at all, no ability to produce or retain energy, let alone use it. Something totally inanimate. I mean, this guy sucked, period. You know, there are other guys on the set where maybe I was like, oh, you know, like the Freebirds. They weren't bad, but they didn't really fit in the AWA. You know, they had a couple good matches, but they didn't really fit in the AWA, and you could tell. You know, and it was kind of disappointing because you wanted there to be some better stuff. Billy Robinson, it was past his prime, but you kind of wished that there was better stuff. His best stuff is really good, you know, the stuff that made the set, the Bockwinkel match, the Jumbo match. But you kind of wish there was better stuff. But the only guy who really, in the true sense of the term, was a stock-going-down guy for me was Steve Regal. That's it. Nobody else. I mean, he's the only.
The Freebirds, you know, we talk about the Freebirds. In all honesty, it was the Freebirds running AWA was mainly Hayes and Roberts. Because Gordy was at that time in Japan, you know, on a regular basis. So basically it was just Hayes and Buddy there. You know, so we got very little Gordy in AWA, which was a shame because he had a great little thing going with Blackwell, which never really materialized into, you know.
God, those would have been great matches. That makes you sick to even think about. But
you okay there, Dylan?
Yeah, I'm getting nauseous just thinking about that. Steve Regal really makes me sick to my stomach. But.
No, he's terrible.
Well, I guess one last question of that kind is, like, who do you guys think is the wrestler that people should most watch out for in this?
Most what?
That people should most watch out for.
Well, let me ask you, Dave, who is the wrestler that you are most looking forward to? I'm going to pose this to you as the because I'm curious to hear what you say.
Hold on. I'm going to answer for Dave. He's fucking Canadian. He's looking forward to Rick Martel. I'm just throwing that out.
I get my Rick Martel fetish from the Montreal footage I have.
and now
Martel,
you are going to get it in droves on AWA. I'm calling.
I would say this is going to seem like I'm just basically being like you know that cartoon with the bulldog walking along with the little tiny dog jumping up and down over its back? Yeah, it's going to seem like I'm Spike to Dylan because I'm going to say Jerry Blackwell.
That's fine because that's basically my answer. I mean, my answer would be that Jerry Blackwell is the guy that people should watch out for because Bockwinkel is going to be in your face. Kurt Hennig is going to be in your face. To a degree, even Greg Gagne. Blackwell's going to be in your face, too, but it's sort of a different dynamic with him. And the other thing I would really tell people to really focus on is pay attention to how good the actual wrestling is in 1986. You know, just forget, try and put out of your mind the fact that
business was going down.
Yeah, that the business is going down. They're not wrestling in these big arenas. And just try and focus on the wrestling. Cause I think
that they have to compare themselves to like something that's going to come out in the 80s later on, and that the NWA in 1986 was the hottest shit ever.
Well,
you know,
look at UWF 1986.
Yeah.
So I'm just
that's just what I would say, is that people should, you know, watch that year especially, that first year where the wrestling is such a high quality, and just watch it and appreciate the wrestling. The feuds are good, too. I mean, you got Hennig versus Bockwinkel. You got Rose and Summers versus the Midnight Rockers, which is, in my opinion, right up there with any – I mean, look, that feud, those matches – are right there with any tag team feud in the history of wrestling, and I say that without a hint of hyperbole or exaggeration.
Of course, yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's right.
So watch those matches for what they are, and I think you're going to be excited by the set. But anyway, Chris, your turn.
I was going to say Rose and Summers is the guys to watch out for as a team. You know, everybody knows about Buddy Rose as a singles guy by now. You know, we pushed that for, you know, a couple of years now. But the Rose and Summers team, especially Doug Summers, was so good. I guess there's such a wide variety of competitors that we have on the set. You know, different types of matches, six-man matches, tag matches. You know, they were it had Sherry as part of the act. They were
God, yes.
You know, they were a fantastic heel act in that year.
Yeah.
Sherry added a lot. She was really great. You know,
she was awesome.
I'm going to throw this out here real quick because we don't have a lot of time left, and I'd like to hear everybody. You know, it's sort of cliche to say, oh, like, what is your working number one, or what is your best match, or whatever. I mean, we can answer that too. We don't necessarily have to do that. But one thing I really do want to ask is, what match would you have people? What match are? I want to know what match Dave is most excited for, what individual match, and then I want to know, and I'll answer this too, what match Chris and Will think people, the kind of under-the-radar match. Maybe it's not your number one, but it's a match that you would encourage people to go, give this match a real chance, and you're going to see something that's either really interesting or really special or really different. Dave, I want you to answer this first. Because
well, hold on, hold on, hold on.
Question,
I did not get to jump in on the last question. But, no, the only thing I want to add to what Dylan said before, and I'll let you do your thing, is do not underestimate those high-flyer matches. I mean, really, don't look at Greg Gagne and one half of the Killer Bees and say, fuck this, they're fighting a bunch of old men. Or look at, like, Jesse Ventura, who's, like, considered the worst guy on any 80s set, and say, fuck this. Watch the high flyer matches. Do not discount those matches. Okay, back to the conversation.
Totally agree. Now, Dave, what's the single match that you're most looking forward to? And if you had to pick one, what is the single match you're most looking forward to? Or how are things most interesting, maybe?
I'm not going to do well with picking one. But what I'll say is, like, I would – one that I'd like to point out that's kind of – might seem like random that I think is just kind of – exemplary of what we're talking about, the random stuff that's on here, is there's a match with the Fabulous Ones versus Wyndham and Rotundo that I think looks pretty interesting. Other than that,
almost didn't make the set.
What's that? Almost
didn't make the set.
Yep.
Oh, wow. But it looks interesting anyways. What I'd say probably either the High Flyers versus Santana and Martel, or basically from everything I've heard about it, Bockwinkel versus Wahoo sounds awesome.
Yeah, those are
fucking awesome.
All of those are good picks.
And what did I say about the Fabs Rotundo Wyndham match when we talked about, you know, which was going on the set? As I told you guys, that was going to be a match that was going to have an interest to people, because
you're right.
At that time, those were the two of the top babyface teams.
I don't remember you saying it.
Well,
he did.
I think it was Will that said it.
No, I don't remember saying it either. I'm just talking shit now. I'm just being this.
Go ahead, Chris. Yeah.
All right. Do you want to talk about under radar match?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give you one that it has guys in there that, you know, we know are awesome and has been featured on the other sets. Well, two of the guys for sure. But nobody really talks about this match being, you know, from the AWA, is the Dundee Lawler versus Original Midnight Express tag title change.
Oh, man, that's an excellent pick.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking forward to that stuff, too.
Dundee's only show in the AWA. They had another match, and they had this match.
So, but you get to see, you know, in a shithole town in Wisconsin, you know, having this great, you know, Memphis-style match. And the fans are into it. You know, it's one of the top tag matches. It is not up there with the Rose Summers Midnight Rockers matches, but it's on the level right below it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's so high, I think.
Yeah, I think
that's pretty faint criticism to
contender.
Say it's not up there with those.
I think that's a top 20 contender anyway. Will, do you want to go next or you want me to go next?
Let me just go real quick. Love and embrace Lord Alfred Hayes versus Bobby Heenan. This was good. I'm glad that Dylan was happy enough to allow to go on the set because it would have been like my one personal pick. Just and I love that it opens the setup. You know, it's just, it's not going to be in anyone's top 10. It might be in my top 10, but it's just a match I want people to watch just to enjoy.
That's a great match, Dave. You'll love it. I think I predicted that you will love it. But
I've never actually.
It doesn't have any no selling of dragon suplexes, but it's close.
Honestly, there's a ton of matches that I could pick, but I'm going to pick another tag title switch, and because there's a lot of stuff you know that we didn't even cover, but this is something we didn't cover at all. It's from 89. It's Brad Rangins and Ken Patera, out of jail Ken Patera, you know, Ken Patera way past his prime, versus Bad Company. And that match is a great match. Not a good match, not an okay match, not a passable match, not good for the time, but a legitimately great match. I think people are really going to be surprised by that because it's really at the dying days of the promotion. And you almost get the feeling these guys don't even have any vested interest to try at this point. And they go out there and have, an excellent match, a match that easily made this set. And I think could finish really high for people. So, this set's filled with matches like this though. So yeah.
All right.
That's that.
Yeah, cool stuff.
Chris, Will, anybody?
Good show.
So, Will, what kind of timeline are we looking at for you to be able to get this out to people? Mostly, when are you able to get it to me?
Before the end of June.
Cool.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I have to look. I'm going to convert all of the stuff in 4-hour mode this week. And there are discs that just for whatever reason, I mean, when you have 20,000 DVDs, shit gets lost, gets misplaced, that I might have to have sent to me. And so, but I got to find out what I have first and what I don't have before I can ask for that to be sent. So this week I look to convert most of the set to 4-hour mode and get all the extras that I can placed. And then whatever discs I don't have, I need to highlight so I get either Chris, Dylan, or K-Hawk to send it to me, and then I'll have it wrapped up. So it'll be out before the end of June.
I'm sure your wife is more than willing to do some of the legwork on figuring some of that out, too.
Yeah, probably not going to happen, man. Yeah.
No.
Okay. No, she's pregnant, and, she's not going to do too much legwork. Yeah.
How so? Plus,
it's kind of hard to do legwork when you're in the closet, just... Yeah.
But that's another good reason to buy this set is
it gets your wife pregnant.
Will's got a pregnant
baby
wife.
Baby needs diapers.
That's right. You know, to help a brother out here. You know, I'm just gonna say this before we go. I really wanted more participation out of the All Japan set, even though I wasn't on the committee, and I can be an annoying bastard. But I can assure you that I am going to be commenting the hell out of these threads for this set and really pushing, trying to have a broader range of discussion for this set than maybe there was with All Japan. There was no range of discussion with All Japan. I'm really going to try and up the ante for this. So
yes.
People who want to argue with me about match quality or wrestlers or whatnot, can feel free to do it in the appropriate form of the Death Valley Driver or elsewhere, but expect me to be really pushing this and, you know, expect my stock picks tonight or tomorrow and make this a – I think this set really has potential to be a real – a set where people discover things. It's not – this isn't going to reinforce a lot of opinions because a lot of people haven't watched any AWA. So that's sort of the beauty of this set is it's you're kind of – it's a blank slate. And I think that has a – because it is a blank slate, there's a lot of potential for watching it and getting entirely new and different things out of it than you haven't – that you've never had before. So that's that. That's my my closing filibuster.
Very good.
Yeah. And, Will, what are I know this is something I've heard you do in some of the other shows of this nature, too. Just what are some of the other projects that are underway right now?
What? No, I would never show anything on a, on a podcast. No, I got this coming out. I got the 1990 yearbook we're working on. I want to do a super-duper Midnight Express set this summer before I go back to work. What else? I don't know, man. I mean, I want to do a super-duper Jerry Lawler extended cut, you know.
And the some of the 80s stuff, like Lucha is on the go, too, right?
Lucha's on the go. I'm going to be watching a lot of Lucha this summer, trying to fill that up. And because I think AWA will go by easier than All Japan, I think we can have the Lucha set out, you know, sooner than we had the AWA set out. Because All Japan had so many big matches, long matches, some of the same matches that create hurdles for people to watch it. AWA, you won't have those same hurdles, you know, because when you get into the feuds where you start seeing multiple matches of the same match, like Hennig, Bockwinkel, or the Rose Summers rocker stuff, that's like the peak of the promotion quality match-wise, so it's going to be real easy to get through that stuff and continue finishing the set. So, yeah, Lucha's after this DVD VR project-wise.
Yeah.
And after that, Portland and the territories, maybe?
The other thing I wanted to throw out there, too, that, I mean, I'm working on getting together as much Canada stuff as I can, and if anybody knows of anything, they can feel free to get a hold of me. I'm kind of a social network shill. I'm not going to go Twitter-ific or here or anything, but if people want to try and get a hold of me with any 80s footage, that'd be great. So,
It would be awesome. And I will take it from you.
Oh, yes, you will. So, okay, well, Chris, first time I've ever actually spoken to you, so great to be in touch with you. And Will and Dylan, thanks for doing the show as always.
Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, and Will, if you want to do the 80s results show for All Japan on here, we're more than willing to do that as well.
I'll talk to our buddy Chris Aronson about it, and we'll get back with you.
Sounds great, bud.
We'll call you.
Everyone, take care.
Talk to you guys later.
Okay, bye.